This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It really disturbs me that we have a wonderful stormwater management plan, and it's not being funded, it's not being implemented, and we're actually doing our drainage the same way that we have for the past 100 years, which is, it's not ideal, it's not smart, it's not living with water, it's living against water.
As the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina approaches, we thought it would be an appropriate time to head back down to the bayou. This week on Sea Change Radio, we hear from the head of the National Audubon Society's Louisiana chapter, Douglas Meffert. We get an update on the coastal restoration efforts of the region, get a sense of how the cleanup from the BP oil spill is progressing, and talk about the ongoing struggles and challenges of the Army Corps of Engineers in New Orleans. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Douglas Meffert. He's the Vice President of the National Audubon Society, as well as the Executive Director of Audubon, Louisiana. Doug, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
Most of us are familiar with the work of the National Audubon Society, but where does Audubon, Louisiana focus most of its energies?
Well, the National Audubon Society is a network of, in some cases, state offices like we have in Louisiana, various sanctuaries and centers throughout the United States, as well as our local chapters, which are our volunteer base. So here in Louisiana, we have Audubon's oldest and largest sanctuary, the Paul J. Rainey Sanctuary in Southwest Louisiana. And that was established in 1924. So we've had a long-term presence here in Louisiana and its coast. Where we're most active here in Louisiana right now is on-the-ground restoration techniques, putting restoration in the hands of landowners. Our coast is 85% privately owned, so that's very critical. Also providing sound science to inform restoration projects that the state is implementing through its coastal master plan. And on the policy side, working both on the federal level and the state level to make sure the best ecosystem restoration projects happen in our coastal zone, and that the funds, for example, from the Deepwater Horizon spill go towards meaningful restoration whenever possible.
And what is the Restore the Mississippi River Delta Coalition, which your organization is part of?
The Mississippi River Delta Coalition is a coalition of which is based on five primary environmental NGO partners working with others. And the main five, it's three national groups, including Audubon, and two regional well-established groups. The other partners are the National Wildlife Federation, the Environmental Defense Fund. The local ones are Lake Pontchartrain Basin Foundation and the Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana. We've been around for about 6 years now as a coalition and have really become a very integrated, solid group that has communications, policy, science, field outreach. And we basically bring out the best of what a national organization can bring in terms of advocacy because of its brand, but also then the local powerhouses that have a voice here in the state.
And we're now looking at the 10th anniversary of Katrina. How have the voices changed? The political environment has changed quite a bit, and some of the players have changed quite a bit, but the people in need are still there. Can you give us kind of a snapshot of the transformation since Katrina?
Sure, absolutely. And let me just say first, when you talk about the people, if not for the powerful social networks that exist in our neighborhoods and in the city of New Orleans and in our rural communities, I don't think we would have seen the resilience that we have had in this area. Since Katrina, The major change in terms of policy and politics, which has had a profound, to me, beneficial influence on our resilience and sustainability, is that we are now, we have merged since Katrina, the authority in the state for levee protection and merged that with the authority in the state for coastal restoration. Before Katrina, the authority for levee protection was within the Department of Transportation, and the authority for restoration was within the Department of Natural Resources. They were separated at that time because there was concern on the, from the restoration community that if the two were merged under one authority, that levees would dominate the funding streams and take away money from the Coastal Trust Fund that was established for restoration. But they were merged after Katrina, and I think that was very useful because when you talk, you know, our levee systems and our wetlands are intrinsically integrated, and the two in concert provide powerful storm surge protection. You know, one of them alone is simply not enough. And what was created is called the Coastal Protection Restoration Authority, which now oversees levee protection and coastal restoration. And the good news is that it's called CPRA, that the CPRA with the restoration side, people like levees and people like wetlands, and the levee dollars have not taken away from the restoration dollars. And back to the people, before Katrina, people really just saw levees as their main line of defense from storm surge. They didn't think about wetlands in that context, but Katrina was a major wake-up call in terms of the importance of our surrounding coastal wetlands in reducing storm surge. So you're not just depending on flood walls and pumping systems within the city. So the community awareness of the integration and the importance of the integration of these systems was a result of Katrina.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the executive director of Audubon, Louisiana, Douglas Meffert. So Doug, we had Bob Marshall on, a journalist who's done some terrific work educating people about Louisiana's shrinking coastline. I recommend our listeners go to the Sea Change Radio archives if they want to hear more about that. One thing that Bob and I didn't really get to touch on, though, was the efforts underway to restore some kind of sane storm policy in New Orleans proper. Can you speak to that?
Sure, I can. I think Bob is a great journalist, by the way. And with the city of New Orleans, well, first of all, the levee system that we had surrounding the city before the storm was not built as it was originally designed. So we're incredibly vulnerable before the storm. Since the storm, we did invest $1.4 billion into storm surge protection barriers on the outskirts of the city. And we now, we were authorized by Congress to establish levee systems that would meet a 1 in 100 level year of protection, which means you have a chance of overtopping the levee 1% in any given year. That's much better than what we had before Katrina. I don't think it's good enough. I would rather have 500 year level protection, but it is much better than what we've had before.
Anybody who's spent any time in New Orleans over the last few years has heard local New Orleanians bemoaning the United States Army Corps of Engineers. They are a thorn in the side of the citizenry there. Is that warranted? What's at the root of the problem?
Well, you know, at the root of the problem, frankly, is that particularly with the levee systems and flood wall systems that failed during Katrina, what was unearthed quite literally was the poor functionality and the poor design and actually designs that were not even consistent with what the Corps was mandated to create. And so between the Corps and then the contractors that implemented and built these structures, something went awry and we had a shoddy system. So I think the animosity is warranted. But what I will also say in the same breath is that, you know, with Audubon, we have a very productive relationship with the Corps of Engineers, and the Corps of Engineers has quite a number of incredible, talented people. And also on the positive side of the Corps, the surge barrier, the 1.7 mile, 1.4 billion surge barrier that was designed to keep storm surges from coming into New Orleans in the future is an amazing feat of engineering, and it was built quite quickly. It's the largest design-build civil works project the Corps has ever done in the United States. So it's just a phenomenal piece of engineering, and it goes in very deep into the substrate. It's very solid. And the cool thing about it is that it's not designed to just keep the water out. It actually is designed to be overtopped. So again, you can let a little bit of water into the city, and you don't have to just build bigger and bigger and bigger to keep all the water out. It can be overtopped.
Why is the Army Corps currently ripping up the city? I can't remember what that's about, because I do remember, though, that I heard several times from people while I was there this year complaining that the Army Corps was just ripping up many main streets simultaneously and really choking traffic because of that.
They are, and it's very annoying. The traffic is very annoying. But you know what's even more annoying to me about that is going back to what the city has done. You know, we have an abundance of water here, and we tend to see it as something to be taken for granted, or to see it as a threat. And really, you know, we need to work with water as much as possible and see it as an asset, like they do in Amsterdam or Waterdam, and use the hydrology and the infiltration capacity of your street systems to absorb water just in even normal rain or storm events. And so you're not completely depending on the storm drains and the pumping systems that are under the city. And after the storm, after Katrina, New Orleans developed an exquisite new water management plan that would rethink the way we look at our canals and bayous in the city, and that we could enjoy them for recreational value. We could enjoy our parks day to day, and in the event of a flood or a heavy rain event, these areas could retain water and let it flow out through gravity instead of, like I said, depending on pumping systems. That construction that you're talking about, it's basically enlarging the subsurface drainage that goes to the pumping systems underneath the city. Those could be canals. Many of those used to be canals. And so it really disturbs me that we're, in this case, we have a wonderful stormwater management plan, and it's not being funded, it's not being implemented, and we're actually doing our drainage the same way that we have for the past 100 years, which is, it's not ideal. It's not smart. It's not living with water. It's living against water.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the executive director of Audubon, Louisiana, Douglas Meffert. So, Doug, Louisiana's home to many, many migratory birds who've been imperiled by the shrinking coastline and also the BP oil spill, of course. Can you tell us about some of the areas your organization's been working on to help save these birds?
Absolutely. We have about 16 million acres of what we call important bird areas in the state, and most of those are in the coastal zone. About 40% of the migratory birds in North America spend part of their life here, right in our coastal zone in Louisiana and in bottomland hardwoods in the north. And the reason Louisiana is so important, the reason Audubon is so active here in Louisiana, it's because with that percent of birds being here, when they're migrating south during our winter, when they're migrating south, Louisiana is the last place that these birds can rest and forage and feed before they cross hundreds of miles across the Gulf of Mexico and make it down to Central and South America. Similarly, during our spring, we're the first place where many of these migratory birds can land and nest and breed before continuing their journey. So it's incredibly and globally recognized important bird habitat, which is why we need to hold on to what we've got and, you know, restore whatever we can with the available resources that we have.
Maybe you can kind of catch us up on the realities and how the bird population has suffered or bounced back from that oil spill.
Sure. And the good news is we don't have any more, we don't have more endangered species than we might have had before, but there were an estimated million birds that were killed in the immediate aftermath of the spill from being coated with oil and exposed to other chemicals. In the long term, it's really going to take decades to see what the transgenerational impacts will be for birds and other wildlife. We've seen components of the chemical in the dispersants in white pelican eggshells up in Minnesota. So these chemicals are actually traveling across the country from migratory birds.
And what birds in particular were most affected?
Mainly water birds. And so so certainly the brown pelican, snowy egrets, great egrets, roseate spoonbills had major impacts from the oil spill. You know, but the other thing too, when you're mentioning BP and that they're giving back to the community.
I'd love to hear your frank evaluation of that assertion.
There are still just millions of gallons unaccounted for. There's oil still deep in the Gulf. There's oil still in the wetlands. And very often when there's even a minor storm event that you see tar balls still coming up on our beaches. Last April, for example, I remember BP came out with their assessment 5 years after the spill. They basically said, everything is okay. Wildlife are okay. The beaches are okay. And then just a few days later, a 25,000-pound tar mat showed up on an island called Grand Terre. That doesn't sound like it's okay to me. An independent scientist from Louisiana State University took a sample of that oil, and it was in fact tagged as being from the BP spill. So that oil is still out there, and it's still being exposed to birds and other wildlife.
And is it just the oil, or is it also the oil dispersant corrects it, which garnered so much negative publicity, probably rightly so, for BP?
There have been some studies showing corrects it in, say, the shells of small crustaceans in the Gulf. Chemicals like that tend to be a little less persistent in the environment, but they have to be weathered. They have to be exposed to sunlight and before they can be dissipated and transformed. But if they're buried, then they're still present. So there is still some corexit in some of the marshes that were exposed to the oil, and as well as the oil itself.
So what we did hear a lot about in terms of trying to repair the damage that the BP oil spill wrought upon the Louisiana coast and other areas in the Gulf was a mass settlement. How have those dollars translated into conservation efforts for you and your colleagues?
Well, I'll first quote Audubon's president, David Yarnold, and say, if you break it, you got to buy it. And they broke the system, and now they need to fix it. And so there are a variety of different funds that are resulting from the BP claims. There's the criminal fines administered through the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. And then on the civil fines side, we're looking through the natural resource damage assessment, which are dollars that go directly to restore damaged wetlands, about $5 billion coming in the next 5-10 years through that. The Clean Water Act, civil penalties will be about $787 million. And there's some other economic claims at about $1 billion. So, and that's really just for Louisiana. The other states will be getting dollars too. So we'll have about $6.8 billion being fueled into our state. And part of what Audubon does with our Mississippi River Delta Coalition partners is to ensure that as many of those dollars go as possible to the shovel-ready but best ecosystem restoration projects possible. And so guiding those dollars to the right projects will be a major task and a major priority for us in the coming years.
I was born way down in Louisiana. I love the weird sound, 'cause that's my home, way down in Louisiana. I'm going back and try to settle down. Gonna settle down, gonna settle down, gonna settle down in my own hometown.
SeaChange Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to SeaChange Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to the executive director of Audubon, Louisiana, Douglas Meffert. So, Doug, how has the seafood industry bounced back since the oil spill, in your estimation?
Well, it that's very much tied to the oil spill as well as coastal restoration. And the seafood industry is bouncing back. You know, the Gulf of Mexico provides 25% of the entire country's seafood, and the majority of those species, whether they're caught in estuaries or in the Gulf, spend their critical nursery time in the estuaries, and the Mississippi River Delta is the largest one of those. And so the really important thing that we need to do is to use a variety of techniques, but in particular, restore the natural processes of the Mississippi River, changing its course every 1,000 years or so over the past 7,000 years, you know, reintroduce as much as possible that freshwater and sediment into the estuaries so that we can rebuild these nurseries for the long-term sustainability of fisheries while we hold on to what we've still got.
And can you talk about how Audubon, Louisiana functions within the ecosystem, for lack of a better word, of other nonprofits down there working to restore the wetlands, your partnerships, and who are you competing for dollars with, essentially?
Well, we work as a team down here, and I think where we tend to delineate from one another is, you know, some of us have a statewide focus, some of us have a regional focus. With Audubon, we do not compete on policy issues for the state and the federal dollars. For example, to just watchdog every year with the state legislative session to make sure that the Coastal Trust Fund is intact and that the dollars that go into that fund go towards restoration and not other uses. That's where we work in concert. Where Audubon has a particular niche in working with others is because we are a landowner here in coastal Louisiana through our sanctuary. We have a very active landowner engagement program, so that tends to be one of our strengths, is to work with landowners across boundaries for large-scale restoration. You know, birds and wildlife and water don't recognize property boundaries, and so I think to the extent that we don't do that, it benefits our ecosystems on a large scale. And the state loves us working with them on that. The other niche we have, of course, is birds, because we're Audubon. And so those habitats that are particularly critical for birds and migratory birds, like barrier islands and rookeries and shorelines, we tend to have a greater emphasis on those as well.
So who was John James Audubon?
Well, he was a gentleman from Haiti who traveled around the United States. He was an avid hunter And as many of us know, an avid painter, he spent a large amount of his time in what's called Oakley Plantation, which is near Baton Rouge, our capital, in Louisiana. And at Oakley, that's where he painted a large number of the birds that he's famous for in his main books. With Audubon, now Audubon has a very interesting history in that we were founded in 1905, back before women had the right to vote. And I mention that because we were actually founded by women. If you think back to that age, you know, the late 1800s and early 1900s, feathers and even birds were all the rage in fashion in terms of millinery, in terms of hats and other decorative items for wardrobes.
And it was one of the first episodes in human history of mass extinction of many different species, correct?
Or threatening the extinction of them, but you're right, just killing birds at breeding season when their plumage is the most beautiful. We were having massive rapid declines of birds like egrets and spoonbills for millinery. And, you know, Florida and Louisiana and Texas were really hit hard. And the group of women started in Boston, frankly, and they were seeing this rampant ravaging of bird populations just for the sake of vanity. And they said, this has got to stop. This has absolutely got to stop, that here we are threatening the extinction of thousands of birds just for our vanity. And so it was this group of women that that started Audubon and started our organizations. It's a really fascinating story.
I'm sure the pushback against these women was similar to what we hear today from the coal industry. And these are good jobs in the millinery industry. Do birds outweigh humans?
Yeah, you know, there was some pushback, but ultimately, you know, there was even pushback from women of society, for example, who really liked wearing their feathers. But ultimately, you know, just like you have any social change or environmental change, there was a strong enough momentum that that milliners and women were, you know, and people were shamed into not wearing feathers. And Audubon was very active in establishing wardens throughout the country to basically keep out poachers. And we're still doing that today.
Well, it's excellent work that you and your colleagues are doing, Doug. Douglas Meffert from Audubon, Louisiana, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Eddie Bowe, Lee Dorsey, and Percy Mayfield. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.